From the Ottawa Journal, have it in front of me. Following the publication of the White Paper, immediate consideration was given to the type of structure required to replace the then existing Chiefs of Staff organization. The final organization chart which emerged was decided upon by the minister and not by the Chiefs of Staff. Admiral Rayner's statement alone proves but any shadow of doubt that the government will not allow both sides of the question to be heard by the committee. You think Canadians understood that?
No.
Do you believe they understood that?
No.
Nigel, I want to make it very clear. I'm not giving an opinion on unification. I'm not giving an opinion on integration. I don't couldn't use those words. I would have had tremendous integration, yes. But I'm trying to point out the end does not justify the means. The end does not justify the means. And
so you say it was a pretty ruthless attack.
Yes.
Would you?
I think.
Well, what is your personal opinion, sir?
My personal opinion is national security must not become a political issue. It must not be a one party stand up. I wrote to Ross Macdonald at the time, and incidentally, I got a nice letter from Rayner to say he'd showed my signal to the Prime Minister. I received your wire this morning and immediately advised the Prime Minister of its content. So, he did that for me. But, as he said in his letter, he was unable to, he had to be neutral. He was chairman of the Defense Committee.
Mm-hmm.
So, I wrote to Macdonald and I had a nice reply from him. I wrote many letters to my friends up there. Here's a letter written at the same time. Thank you for your letter. I, of course, realize there could be no answer from you to the question, is government granting neither recognition nor tolerance to those of different opinions? One of the other admirals wanted me to include that. David, I tried to explain at our frank meeting last month, never have I given an opinion on government policy regarding integration or even unification. I've merely asked that those officers who must carry responsibility to make government policy a success and who we must depend upon to give leadership when the real danger arises are held in high regard and not undermined as they have been by the government of the day. You've known me for nearly 30 years, and possibly you can understand how it has hurt me with more than I can say to find of the 79 generals, admirals, and commodores fired or retired, 40 well below retirement age, there has not been one word or question from any member of the present government which I had supported. Could there not have been some way to avoid this? That answers your question. I have never taken a stand on integration, which is very necessary, and we were going ahead in it, probably slower than we should have been. But one minister, who incidentally was a draft dodger from the Second World War, comes in and implements a thing with an executive assistant called Leaky Lee, who didn't know how to fly an airplane, but he was a squadron commander, wing commander, and these two, and they divided the service. They divided admirals against generals, and there was always those who, there was one admiral who you probably interviewed here, who told me one time, if you can't beat him, join him, which I've never spoken to him since, but if you can't beat him, join him.
Mm-hmm.
There was a certain amount of that in the services at the time.
What's your opinion of the Air Force? Do you think they were snake in the grass, if you will?
I think they're the grandest people.
No, I'm talking about people, but I'm talking about the Air Force people that were there that seemed to put their weight right behind the whole process.
You see, the Air Force has always been either part of the Navy or part of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
It's what they've been brought up to,
mm-hmm.
to be. They've always worked for the Navy or for the Army. Why not work for both? You know, I have no criticism of them.
Okay.
I have no criticism. I'm not going to be critical of them. The Army were... well, the Army have never been integrated or unified. They really should have started getting the Army into one body. They've given up cavalry, but they're great people, too. It's a unit that matters. You know, there's so much to this that...
I want to know a couple things here.
Yes, sir.
Okay, number one, you have very low opinion of Hellyer.
Yes,
what he did. Would you concede that Hellyer had his back against the wall and could have no other option but to win or resign? Can you concede that?
I would concede that, because Nanny Moore took him to task, and he called... You know, he called Vandy Moore disloyal. Here I have a cutting on that. No wonder Defense Minister Hellyer withdrew his disloyalty against Admiral Vandy Moore. One glance at the record of the two men is enough to see why the accusation would never stick. First things first, it was possible to enlist for active service at the age of 18. When the Second World War started, Hellyer was 16 and Vandy Moore was 23. By 1941, the Minister of Defense was old enough to enlist. 1941, Vandy Moore had seen active service at Dunkirk and had two of his three ships shot out from under him. While this disloyal sailor was fighting for Canada, the Minister-to-be was studying at the Curtis Wright Technical Institute at Aeronautical Engineering in California. In 1943, the Admiral was serving aboard the cruiser Belfast in the Battle of the Atlantic and on the destroyer Grenfell in the Arctic patrols. The same year, Mr. Hellyer was in an aircraft plant at Port Erie. The Minister finally joined up in 44 when he served in the RCF. In 45, he was moved to the Royal Canadian Artillery. He never left Canada. Meanwhile, back in Pacific, the Admiral was serving aboard HMCS Uganda, a cruiser. He continued to serve on active duty until the war ended. Admiral Ward de War was awarded the OBE and twice mentioned dispatches. At the close of the war, Mr. Hellyer was serving his fellow Canadians over the counter in the ladies' underwear store, Mary Jane Fashions. The Minister must have had a gnawed sense of values of that what constitutes loyalty and national service when he called Admiral Vandy Moore disloyal.
Sums it up, then.
I think that puts it in a nutshell, doesn't it?
Okay.
It's a unit.
Okay, now... What about, as you say, these good people retiring and leaving early? I mean, there was a great number. Did you view it as a bloodbath, or how did you view that, sir? All these people going.
It's a great tragedy. It never happened. It was the finest people who'd, finest officers we ever had left the service. I got lists of them here. I'm not going to get them out now, but all our best officers left. Nobody. It was the weaker ones that went on with this thing. It was, you know, the old toast they have at night, a sickly season or a bloody war. I call this integration period or unification a sickly season. It's a wonderful way for young people who'd never otherwise be promoted to get promoted. We haven't had better officers than those that got out from under on this one. Bob Monsell, I won't name them all. All the good ones left under this.
What about those that stayed, though? Do you think
they tried? Good? Many tried to stay. Many stayed on with a view to try and
make what the best they could
to save what they could of the system.
Save what they could, yeah.
To save what they could of the system. I had lunch with Hellyer last year, and they teased me afterwards. I never brought up unification to him, but I sized him up very well, and I just said, Mr. Hellyer, you ran for leadership of the Liberal Party. You were Deputy Prime Minister. Now you've turned into a very strong and ran for Conservative. Tell me, what are the national objectives of the Conservative Party that make you now a strong Conservative? And he went red in the face and sputtered and squirmed and couldn't answer me. Well, then I said, well, why did you leave the Liberals? He said, well, that's an easy question. That's an easy one. But after my first question, the other people at my table, Judge Osler, Dick Bauer, General Finn Clark, others were there. They put a knife into him, but he just could give no reason why he'd now run as head of the Conservative Party. Because I can't understand, as I said earlier, why we can't have free votes in the country. I think it'll be the end of our system. Party politics will bring us to our knees, eventually.
How did you feel when they dressed the boys in green? How did you feel when the sailors were dressed in green?
Well, you know, after a third of a century, you get very, we overdo it. Many of the true and wonderful things that are said about the family can be said about the basic unit, the regiment or the ship, to which a man belongs in the armed forces. He and all others in it have a great loyalty and feeling of identification and even of security in being a part of such a basic unit. Just as true as in a family unit. Here are people living together in mutual helpfulness, protecting one another's interests, just as a family unit. A basic unit in the armed forces confers personhood. Only in it can a person be fully himself. In a basic unit, a man has status by existence, whereas outside he has to win recognition by accomplishment. Everyone has a desire not only to be a person, but to be part of something, to belong. In the basic unit, he finds a sort of fellow feeling and mutual identification for which we, in the natural expression, that is no greater proof of this man in the fact that good armed forces units, after 2 or 4 years together with discipline and comradeship, produce wonderful results. Those are words I wrote at the time to Senator Ross McDonald. And he wrote back to me and he said, assured me that it won't happen, what I was worried about. I don't think Mike Pearson had a clue what. I didn't have a clue. Most things that were going on, bless his heart. Nice man. I loved him dearly. I had lunch with him. I know his wife. He left this to Paul Hellyer. But you do get my point, don't you? That it wasn't integration that hit me. It was the fact that I don't think politics, a politician should run a thing. They should set policy. Government is a policy committee and not an administrative body. This is why I voted Conservative in the last election. God knows what will happen to it. But I cannot identify myself with government running things. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to do that, I'm going to join the NDP and become a socialist or communist and get into that field.
Yeah.
I think government is a policy committee.
Do you think unification, integration, whatever the hell we call it today, what has been done with the forces, has weakened them, other than the officers leaving and things?
Oh, yes. It's coming back, though. It's coming. The pointy end, fortunately, it never got too much into the ships and the units. They, our loyal officers were just roughing up on the government to see that it didn't hit them too hard. And as I stood before the Terra Novas the other day, I looked them in the eye, and a fine lot of men they were, a fine men. The actual units, it has never affected too much. We never, of course, allowed it to get to Hellyer's idea of, you know, cooking the Army is the same as the cook in the Air Force and kicking the Navy. As I told you, they're all the same, they can't cook. I've said a lot on unification, but you have got my point, haven't you? My integration. Mm-hmm. We must integrate more. We should have gone faster than we were. Government should not And we should not allow ourselves to get in the position where government had to push us a bit.
Yeah.
I'll give you that. I'll give you all that.
Do you think Blandymore did a disservice?
He did a great service to the nation. He did a great service to Canada and a great service to the nation, and he'll go down in history as even Helge told me when he was having lunch with me the other day, I should never, never have tried to unify the services. I should have unified the high command. Those are his words to me.
Why doesn't he say that to the country, though?
Give that man's never.
After the unification, had you ready to give up the ghost or what?
No, a lovely time. Great time.
Other things you're involved in.
I was involved. Well, I had a few directorships. I was asked to put on the board of the advisory board of the Royal Trust, which I've enjoyed. I've been on that now for a quarter of a century. I was on the board of the Aero Survey. They survey all across Canada and do air survey work. I'm on the board of governors of the commissionaires for 18 years. I'm on the board of directors of the Cancer Foundation. I'm now honorary vice president of that. Then I had a hobby, the Armed Services Center. I stayed on that. There's unlimited things to do. I've chaired the church drives, and I've chaired the Heart Foundation, and things of that nature. Lots to do. Never had a dull moment, and I'll never catch up.
You're also involved with the Duke of Edinburgh Awards.
Yes. I've been 6 years on the National Council of that. That's a wonderful, wonderful plan. That's to develop the type of people we developed in the armed forces, the unit.
Now, do you believe that the reason you're involved with that is because the armed forces aren't getting the people they should be?
Well, the armed forces are getting good people now.
Oh, okay.
I think, at least what I see of it, I didn't join the Duke of Edinburgh Awards with a view of, it had nothing to do with the armed forces.
Okay.
Building people. You know what the Duke of Edinburgh Award is, do you? It's Prince Philip's challenge to youth. Program of enriching incentives and awards for individual achievement, for the development of qualities in our adult citizens of tomorrow, of integrity, self-reliance, moral fortitude, perseverance, and endurance.
Mm-hmm.
That puts it in one swoop. And we've had people interested in that. Very interesting how many people in the services get involved. Petty officers, retired.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's a fabulous thing. Most of these things that you've been on, though, have been purely volunteer on your part, is that correct?
That's correct.
And,
the only two paying ones were the Aero Survey and the Duke of Edinburgh Awards. Oh, I get a nice honorarium for the Royal Trust, too.
Okay, but no, I guess what I'm getting at is just thinking that it'd be a fair financial strain and other things, but... I guess what I'm hedging at is that was your pension sufficient? Now you retired in 56, and with inflation and things like that today.
It is hard on some people. I have this fortune having a little nest egg put aside, and my wife had the nest egg put aside, so
mm-hmm.
Finances have not been a worry to me.
No, I realize that, sir. I'm not getting that. I'm just wondering how your pension, and you could say your colleagues that say had to rely entirely on pension.
It was very hard for years. Now they pushed it on to, they pushed it up about 10 years ago, wasn't it? And they increased the pensions to meet the inflation since their retirement. And the pension was tied into inflation. Mike Pearson put that in for us. mind you, I don't agree with the principle of civil servants and the services having pensions tied into. I don't agree with it in principle. I say pay a man while you're employing him, and let him save his money and put it aside. That's a better. It produces a better citizen than paying him in afterlife. Let him do this. I'm a funny type, aren't I? You don't. it's the wrong approach to it, but I'm glad they did it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't...
You didn't refuse to cash
the check? No.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you feel might be useful right now that you can think of? That you have been involved with since retirement that...
Something that goes through my mind as I think back on these days a great deal. And it's very clear to me, and I think for you may have got the same impression from what I've said on the many hours we've discussed these problems. The Navy has always been successful in being manned by experienced sailors and officers who were capable of leading ships and men under trying conditions. Such persons who have proved themselves in battle were capable of stating the requirements of the fleet and were fine commanders at sea. The bigger things in life are sometimes difficult to put into words, but those who've had experience usually show the best judgment and the best leadership and have confidence and support of the others. On the other hand, whenever the Navy was led by those who had not been proven at sea, we fail. I'll give you a few with examples. Would you like to hear my examples of them? First example was a period during the war when very few of the Naval Board, had any idea of the requirements of the fleet or knowledge of the circumstances at sea. Mm-hmm. That wasn't their fault. They were senior officers at the time. They'd had, between the First World War, when they were midshipmen or at that level, there'd been no war and they found themselves in command. I'm not being critical of them. I want to be very clear on that. We successfully overcame that difficulty, largely due to the challenge. We remained united. One chief of naval staff, Admiral Nellis, was relieved, but nothing more serious occurred. At the end of the war, I found myself as Captain D and was told to pay off ships faster than could be done with any degree of efficiency, and also told, instructed to prepare certain ships to fight in the war in the Pacific. That was, remember when I told you I was Captain D. Halifax. Flying to Waterloo, I was so outspoken to the minister in front of the chief of naval staff, I was soon to leave, but was assured that all would be well and that the Navy would be told to serve in the Pacific and not just Pacific volunteers. I make this point very clearly. I explained to you earlier. As I explained, it puts officers and men in an impossible situation. Doesn't an officer say, or a man say, I'm not coming home to you, I'm going off to fight in the Pacific? He doesn't know what the situation is. When the Prime Minister announced only Pacific volunteers would be sent, there was almost a mutiny. Now, this is one of the bigger things I've had to do in life. Few understand or know how captains or frigates or senior officers of groups of ships, and many who are leaders in Canada today, came to my office so disturbed that there could have been very, very serious trouble, right in the middle of the war. It was necessary to take a very firm stand when I was Captain D. Halifax. I agreed with these fellows. The government had let them down. We were at war. No government, I told the men, I fell them in by the thousands. I said, no government decisions must be undermined. I let it be known that I would not hesitate to court-martial insubordination. I had no one to turn to. My senior officer, CNC Western Atlantic Admiral Murray, had been relieved after the Halifax riots. The chief of naval staff was in temporary command at Halifax, but he accepted government decisions. The ammunition from the ships exploded as the government had been told it would, and they covered it up by their mistakes by paying all costs, no questions asked. That was a very, very serious position for me. I agreed with my men that were coming to me. They were just pretty bloody minded after 6 years at sea and 6 years of the war. They were prepared to blow. I had to hold them down, and yet I agreed with them.
It's lonely at the top, sir.
We're terribly loyal, you know. We're almost too loyal as service people. Now again, the next problem came after the war in 1947. We had trouble in the fleet. You may remember the Mingy report, do you? And I told the Mingy report at the time. It was caused by lack of leadership and respect. It dated back to lack of confidence in the government and the naval board during the war and inexperienced officers. Pacific volunteering, etc. All these matters had built up and gone down, trickled down into the Navy. The Mingy report did not quote my words, but could not disagree with me with this opinion under very severe questioning. Historians like yourself will read what the Mingy report said, not anything else. So I don't know how an historian will ever get the true answer of this, of volunteering for the Pacific, and how serious that was at the time. The next milestone was the integration policies of the government. Well known, what we've talked about today. But in spite of all, in the Korean War, we were the only service ready for combat, and the efficient Navy grew because we had experienced officers and senior men battle-trained both at headquarters and at the coast after the war. The most recent opinions I have obtained from the Royal Navy and U.S. Navy and others are that the modern Canadian ships designed and built in Canada, manned by Canadians, trained by Canadians, are highly regarded throughout the world. In more recent years, we start to appoint to high positions a number of very senior officers who had not proven leaders at sea, the final destined ground for us all. This is more recent. Some had either not been there or had failed, and questions were again being asked in the fleet. It could now be argued that experience at the top was unnecessary in the Navy itself, and there was an undertone, which led to the Plummer Report. Do you remember the Plummer Report? Plummer Report was criticism of the senior officers of the Navy. The Navy building program announced in 1962 and the subsequent cancellation cut the ground from under the feet of Naval Board. The Navy itself was not united in this program, which was approved by one government, canceled by another. A few wishful thinkers would say that it was cut in costs. The Plummer Report, tabling the white paper, all these discussions on defense matters made with the support and cooperation, if they're made with the support and cooperation of our top military leaders, it will be very happily carried out. Decisions made by government must be put in the hands of the services to be carried out.
You don't want the government in there doing it?
No.
Tell us what to do in the service and we'll do it for you.
And we're so loyal, we're just unbelievably loyal on this.
That's part of the job, you know.
We'll bend over backwards, but I'll never understand how so many citizens of Canada, the citizens of Canada don't understand what a government's supposed to do. They look upon a minister as God Almighty. Heaven's sakes alive, I can remember in Britain when I was in the National War College, we had a state here, we had a minister that they didn't dare tell the top secret things to.
Ignorance is bliss, I guess.
Well, don't you feel yourself, Chris, that a country does not understand the function of government, the role of government in a free enterprise economy?
Quite right. They don't even know how we elect people in this country. Huh? They don't know. They don't even know the election, the electoral process.
They don't understand. They don't understand the function of government. I mean, the country doesn't know how unfortunate it is to have such loyal people. Now, for example, it was considered. You never talked to a politician when he came to your ship. You gave him a drink and you walked the other way. Political influence is about the lowest form. I think it's in Article 1, Articles of War. There'll be no political influence. You're court-martialed if you show any signs of using political influence. Rightly so.
Well, you being lawyers.
Right. I can remember. Dear old Book Claxton, who died, a great, great friend of mine, sent me for my chief and said, all I have to do is recommend anybody for a promotion or an appointment when I'm on defense counsel. Mm-hmm. And he never gets it. And fortunately, Harold Grant, who was my boss at the time, said, that's the only way the system will work. People don't understand that, do they? Mr. Claxton died, a great, great friend of mine. And I had difficulties with him, but he understood it in the end. He did more for the armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to cabinet defense with him, and I've seen him. I was there when the carrier went through. And people of the caliber of C.D. Howe and Doug Abbott and Claxton and Ilsley, I've served in Ottawa and seen these people. These were excellent people. I became a dyed-in-the-wool liberal under those people. Mackenzie King was the chairman of a board, and never had, he and I lived in different worlds.
Everybody lived in different worlds.
But these were outstanding people. And we're very fortunate to have them. But if you want to get politics into the service, you'll get the service into politics. And that's exactly what Hellyer and the Defense Committee, and I hope I made it clear, that Defense mm-hmm. Committee. I have something here. This is to David Groose, who was at that time right in the middle of it. Dear David, as we never meet now, and I'd like you to do so for some time, is a matter of great concern to all of us who stop and think. That is, our basic freedoms are being undermined and in greater danger from within than they've ever been from without. Most of our elected representatives, all parties, would appear to give more consideration and thought to their image and being re-elected than to their integrity. In the past, I've always thought that we should have party politics with a loyal opposition and few parties. But recent experience in the past 10 years has shown that members of a party will do anything to improve that party's chances of being elected or re-elected. The debate on capital punishment was possibly an exception. Mr. Diefenbaker appeared to use every underhand attack with no constructive action or policy and would appear to have lost the confidence of all thinking people. Mr. Pearson's inability to listen to his advisors on Canadian affairs, not foreign affairs, and his method of destroying Mr. Diefenbaker, including the Munsinger affair, have disgusted the nation. To understand the major problems facing the nation and causes of our difficulty is very difficult indeed. And I, for one, admire and would want to support anyone who is genuinely attempting to face the real issues and causes of our trouble and to help wherever possible. But the end does not justify the means. Without going into the different points now, but to quickly mention national defense, there's something to be done, something had to be done. The issue was never integration. It was not even unification to the point. The real issue is that an elected representative takes over supreme command and granting neither recognition nor tolerance to those of different opinions, regardless of their training, their experience, their ability or responsibility. This same elective representative controls all information to the public, which is designed to build himself, not those who we must depend on to lead us when the dangers arrive. And as a result, all top key commanders in both Ottawa and the commands have quit since the first of the year to the impossible situation. Some were fired without first informing the Chief of Defense Staff. We must face the question fairly and squarely now, as apparently the minister can fire anyone without even laying a charge, let alone proving it. All persons considering joining the forces must be so informed. Landy Moore and Brock spoke only after they were fired. I've been away a great deal this year and out of touch, but so many of your friends tell me that you go along to get along. As a past shipmate and a supporter of yours up to date, I've said that you are loyal and have integrity. We now must find out whether or not you support bringing politics into the service and a complete political administration of our armed forces. If only half of what I'm told is correct, this would appear to be the case. But, David, I cannot bring myself to believe you would sell your soul. My quarrel is not with integration. It is with the political control of everything. When the Liberal member for Halifax tells me he's going to make a motion, I'm informed he will. to slow down, Mr. Henry. I trust you will speak up. The hottest place in hell is reserved for anyone who would remain neutral. On the defense committee, Landy Moore, etc., must be heard, not just fired for no reason. I've been informed again that you vetoed debate on unification in the defense committee. This is true. Please let me know. He showed this letter to the prime minister, I'm glad to say. Here's the following letter. Dear David, thank you for your letter. That's in reply. What I told you here, I advised the prime minister, if you don't. Thank you for your letter. I, of course, realize that there could be no answer to the question, is the government granting neither recognition nor tolerance? Those are different opinions. What position are you taking? No answer to that side. David, as I tried to explain in our frank meeting last month, never have I given an opinion on government policy regarding integration. I have merely asked that those officers who must carry responsibility to make government policy a success and who must depend upon to give leadership under real danger arises be held in higher regard and not undermined as they have been. You've known me for nearly 30 years, and possibly you can understand how it has hurt me more than I can say to find of 79 generals, admirals, and commodores, far to retired, 40 well below retirement age, there has not been one word or question of any member of the present government of which I had supported. Find Jimmy Hibbert. I've talked a lot today.
Well, I think we got her covered, Admiral Hibbert, and I'd like to thank you very much for providing the time all along for me, and it's been fun. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you. You'd be easy to talk to. You'd be very nice to talk to.
Okay.